Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hello, and welcome to A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Linda Palacio, your host, and today A Taste of the Past is being sponsored by Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to www.hearstranch.com. Well, today we are, we'll talk a little bit about sustainable meat and vegetables. But I just had a guest motor in, rumble in on his motorcycle, and today's guest is Seamus Mullen. Seamus, welcome.
Good morning.
Seamus is a chef. He is the chef and co-owner of two Boquerias. Boqueria and the Flatiron on 19th Street.
And Soho on Spring Street.
Down in Soho. And I thought it was really very cool because this this month's issue of Sever Magazine is all about markets, and the center spread, if you will, the centerfold, is a cartoon of La Boqueria.
In Barcelona.
Yeah, in Barcelona. And I assume that that's where the name is
that
taken from.
That's the source for the inspiration for the name for the restaurant. I was actually just at La Boqueria in Barcelona last week.
Wow, great.
It's an amazing place.
Yeah. Now, Seamus, you have to tell our listeners who are not perhaps aware about Boqueria. Boqueria is a tapas restaurant.
Yeah, it's a tapas and regional Spanish restaurant. Small plates, seasonally based, and obviously inspired by the market. So we do, and we're close to it, the Union Square Farmers Market. So we do a lot of market-inspired traditional Spanish food.
Mm-hmm. Well, another little item that maybe people would recognize your name from is that you just recently did a little stint on Iron Chef America on Food Network.
I was on a program that they started two seasons ago called Next Iron Chef, in which they kind of vet the next Iron Chef to join the ranks, and there were 10 of us that were competing. So over a 6-week period, we were all vying for the position of next Iron Chef.
No, what, that's fun. I mean, without spilling the beans about the secrets of television, I mean, mm-hmm. What was the most challenging part for you about being on Iron Chef?
It's a different kind of long hours. I mean, in the restaurant industry, we're used to being on our feet for 15, 16 hours in a row.
And cooking under pressure.
Yeah. But time flies. I mean, last night we were incredibly busy. I went to work at 10 in the morning and I got home at 1 in the morning, but it went by like that. Mm-hmm. A 9-hour day in television where you stand for 2 hours and then you take one step and then you do that over again 15 times is a completely different kind of exhaustion.
That's what I was saying. Yeah. Don't spill the beans about the magic of television. Everyone thinks you're doing it on the fly.
Though the thing about Iron Chef that is true is that when the clock starts and you've got an hour to do something, you have an hour to do something. Cameras roll and they don't stop. So there's no BS in that.
Mm-hmm. But let's don't get too carried away, folks, with reality TV, because it's a lot of unrealness to the reality TV. But it's fun. It's fun and we love it, and you were right up there till the end almost.
Yeah,
right?
I was out of 10, I was the third to last. I almost made it, and we were in Japan competing at the very end, and it was
but how cool was that?
It was amazing.
Travel, yeah.
I mean, going, you know, I'm obviously a big market junkie, and going to the Tsukiji fish market was one of the most amazing places
that was in
I've
the Sever magazine
life.
As well.
It's beautiful, amazing, phenomenal.
That would really be something to see. I've seen films of it, that's all.
It's a fish market that smells like apples. It's amazing.
Leave it to the Japanese. Yeah. Well, tell me, you got interested in Spanish food because through just going and living abroad and falling in love with the culture, right?
Yeah.
How did you happen upon, I mean, after a couple other cooking stints and you decided to really go with your love and your passion, why did you hit upon tapas?
Well, I mean, there are a number of reasons. I came back from Spain. I'd been working in Spain, and I came back to New York, and there were very, very few Spanish restaurants in New York. I mean, there's still, there are a few more now, but at the time, and this is in 2004, 2005, there were very few Spanish restaurants in New York, and there's only one or two that was really doing a good job. Alex at when she was at Tia Paul, who's now at Chiquito,
right.
She was doing great food, but outside of that, there was really not very much going on. And the time was kind of right for doing Spanish food in New York. There was a lot of interest in Spain, primarily at the high end, at the kind of the more avant-garde sort of experimental cuisine. But I think that created a general interest in Spain, and people wanted to explore more of the traditional food and the foods of the past, which is, I think, something that we're going to talk about today. And I kind of wanted to get on that. That's what really interests me more than anything is traditional cooking. So yeah. I wanted to do something in New York that really hadn't been done before.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, out years ago, and I don't even know if it's still around. Maybe it's still around. In New York, there was a tapas sherry wine bar called Solera.
Mm-hmm. And it's still around.
Is it still around?
Yeah.
And other than that, tapas was, to Americans, was relatively, or to New York, was a relatively new thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm really surprised that there aren't a lot more tapas bars around, because it's such a terrific way to taste a lot of different foods and just sit and be social and
no
drink.
No commitment. Yeah. You just have, you know, you jump in with some friends and you have a couple of bites and you eat as much as you want. You can sort of scale it. You can have a bite. You can have one little plate of meat and cheese, or you can like have a full blown meal.
Yeah. Of course, the notion is you're supposed to be drinking along with it,
course.
Right?
Yeah. That's where it comes from.
Tell us a little bit more about the history of, I mean, tapas. There's a lot of folklore attached to tapas. Do you know anything more, having spent so much time in Spain? What do you know about the history of tapas?
Clearly, the real idea behind anything like salty peanuts at the bar is to get the patrons to drink more and spend more money.
Right.
The word tapas or tapa literally means top or a lid to a container. And one of the stories is that in southern Spain, where it's really hot in the summer, there was a whole issue with contamination of flies flying into people's into their sangria, and so they passed a law that every bar had to serve a little plate of food to put on top of it to cover the drink when the patrons were
attract more flies, right?
Which of course would attract more flies, but that's with most things, with most folklore, it's wrought with problems.
Yeah, right. Well, it's a good story anyway, and I think it's a wonderful tradition, and what you're doing is really presenting a lot of, as you said, a lot of the traditional foods and the older foods. What are some of these foods and how, you know, that are really traditional and are they regional? So you're serving different parts of Spain.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things that we kind of always have in the back of our mind when we're thinking about food at the restaurant is this concept of tradition being born out of necessity. Spain was a very, very poor country for a long time in a dry region, and preserving proteins was extremely difficult. And they really became over the years masters of preserving, using salt to preserve things, like obviously the ham, famous for the Ibérico ham, the bacalao, the salt cod, their anchovies, all of these preserved products, which sort of evolved so that people could consume protein over long periods of time without, you know, they could store it without refrigeration.
Right.
But obviously in today's world, it's not a necessity to pack anchovies in salt or to make salt cod. But the flavor and the changes in the way the protein develops because of this process has become really the essence of what is Spanish cuisine. So we do a lot with that. We do a lot of things with bacalao, with salt cod. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we use a lot of cured meats. We make a lot of our own
meats. I was reading that. You do make your own cured meat.
Yeah, we make some. We've made more in the past. It's challenging, but at the same time, we can get a product that's a much higher quality than what we can purchase just because we're right next door to the Hudson Valley. We've got wonderful pork to work with.
We just did a show on cured meats with Gabe Ross just a couple of weeks
ago.
Yeah,
very cool. Yeah. So there's a lot of great stuff that we can work with here to kind of give our own take on cooking in the language of Spanish food.
And of course, you make the patatas bravas.
The patatas bravas,
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, they're good. And you know, they're deceptively simple and difficult because it's one of those things. It's like making churros that has three ingredients in the case of churros, but it's all about the process And with patatas bravas, I mean, we have, it's about the potato that you use. It's about the temperature you cook them. It's about how you cook them. They're, you know, it's a three-step process. And to get something that seems so simple, just some fried potatoes.
Yeah, and it's just, and they are addictive.
And that's why they're so
totally good. Addictive, yeah. Right? Well, at the restaurant, what I think is also very, I guess, social and a very interesting new innovative concept is that you have a lot of long tables, a lot of mm-hmm. communal tables, and that being kind of a new popular thing over the past few years. Yeah. And you said, but what a better thing to do with tapas, obviously.
Yeah, to share.
To share and with that, yeah.
We have there's a couple that was in the restaurant, and they stopped me. I happened to be walking through the dining room. They stopped and said, oh, chef, we just wanted to tell you that we're here on our, we're here celebrating the, our anniversary. And they're sitting at the communal table, and which I was like, oh, that's great. I'm glad you're here to celebrate your anniversary. And they said, and we actually met at this table in your restaurant.
Oh,
said, oh, that's great. And they said, and we were actually both on dates with other people, but we ended up talking to each other. And then she was also pregnant. So it was one of those great. It was one of those great. So, well, she was pregnant now with their
yeah,
baby.
Well, I assume.
So yeah. And so it was one of those great stories of the communal table actually working, where
yeah.
people get to know each other and things work out. So it's really nice.
Well, what a great story. That's wonderful. Well, when we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about not just the meats. We'll talk about some other foods too. Okay.
Great.
When the moon's kind of dreamy, starry-eyed and dreamy, and nights are luscious and long, if you're kind of lonely and all by your only, then nothing but the blues are brewing, the blues are brewing. When the wind through the willow blows across your pillow and tells you sleeping is wrong, if love goes a-thirsting till you feel like bursting, then nothing but the blues are brewing, the blues are brewing. Suppose you want somebody, but you ain't got nobody. You only got a gleam in your eye. Till somebody's found you and puts their loving.
Hi, we are back, and we're talking with Seamus Mullen, the chef and co-owner of Boqueria Restaurants, and almost Iron Chef.
Close,
yeah. You serve a lot of local ingredients at the restaurants. And we were talked about your house-cured meats and a lot of local ingredients, obviously echoing what your experience was in Spain with everything being locally procured.
Yeah.
But you're no stranger to local ingredients and farm ingredients. You have a little bit of a background there on a farm.
Yeah, I grew up in Vermont on a small sort of sustainable organic farm. And my parents raised everything from chickens to sheep to cattle, and we had our own milk and eggs and lots of produce. So I've kind of been around food from the source of food since an early age, and I think that had a lot to do with my becoming a chef.
Oh, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's such an intimate relationship with...
You can go one of two ways. You can either say, I don't want anything to do with that. I mean, I did flee the country and end up in New York City, but
yeah.
I still have, I still have roots in the farmland.
Yeah. Well, when you, I've heard that you do spend a lot of time back there.
I go up, and well, I was up actually with your son Zach in the fall, and we're doing a lamb slaughter, which was really, really amazing. And I try to get up a few times a year, and we're always cooking right out of the garden, which is the most amazing thing, to go in the morning, go and collect eggs, and then look what's in the garden, pick it, and cook it within, you know, minutes. It's just incredible.
Well, now, before we went on the air, you told me that you are developing a garden on your roof. And yeah. Here at Roberta's, they have a roof garden we talk about a lot, and they've started LaGrange, a big roof garden. Do you intend to use the produce from that for the restaurants?
Yeah, I'd like to use some of it. I have, you know, I don't have a whole lot of stuff growing because I don't have a lot of square footage, and it's all in containers, but I have a lot of tomatoes. I've got about 10 different varieties of tomatoes growing. I've got pimientos de padrón, the padrón peppers from.
Oh, could I just put some of those in my garden?
Yeah, they're doing really well. They're actually starting.
Are those hot? Are they? Those are milder peppers, aren't they?
Yeah, well, what they say is pimientos de padrón algunos pican y otros no, which means some are spicy and some aren't. They say 1 in 10 is hot. So if you get a hot one, you're lucky.
So it's you just gotta.
Yeah, try, but otherwise they're usually not very hot. So I've got those growing, and I've got 3 or 4 different other varieties of peppers, and cucumbers, and some really nice eggplant, lettuce, and herbs. So we've been using the herbs and some of the baby lettuce already in the restaurant, which is really nice. And
I think the roof gardens are the wave of the future.
Yeah,
because I mean, look at it's good for our bodies and good for saving the roof and the wastewater and everything.
It's space that people, you know, typically aren't using anyway.
And right.
It's so nice in New York City to escape the all the concrete and everything, to get away and just have a little oasis surrounded by greenery.
And what better way than to put it to use and put it on the table?
Yeah, exactly.
I know. Every time I live nearby the one of your boquerias, and every time I walk by, it is, people are pouring out the door. I mean, it's a line to wait. You know, wait to get in. And I always think, oh, maybe I'll just stop in for something. Oh, maybe I won't stop in. Yeah. You know, it's they're always 10 deep at the bar and at the door. And it's wonderful to see, because we were talking about tapas and how there aren't that many tapas restaurants in New York. What do you think the most, I guess, difficult thing for people to accept about it, where it hasn't? I mean, you have made wonderful inroads, and people love, I mean, grazing in small plates, that's been popular for many years now.
Certainly.
Do you think people just aren't, they don't consider it dinner? I mean, what do you think was the hardest thing for them to get used to?
Well, I think part of it was a lack of familiarity with Spanish food. We don't have the same history with Spanish food in the U.S. that we have with Italian food or French food. And there are far more, you know, we've had waves of Italian immigrants in the U.S. So there have been, for a very long period of time, there's been an established Italian culinary tradition. And then obviously French food has kind of been has set the bar for fine dining and gastronomy in the U.S. for years. There hasn't been the same sort of familiarity with Spanish food in the U.S., primarily because very few Spaniards emigrated to the U.S. If they did leave Spain, they went to Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Some went to France. But for the most part, there aren't really large communities of Spanish people in the U.S. So I think that has something to do with the sort of slow acceptance of tapas in the U.S. And partly, I think you're right, that small plates, people don't always think of them as, oh, yeah, I would go there maybe for a snack, but I'm not going to go for a full-on meal.
Or this isn't dinner, not realizing they've consumed enough calories.
Exactly, yeah. It is very much dinner, and it's dinner in a great way, where you can kind of graze and try all these different things instead of just shooting it all on one big plate of whatever it is, you know?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the regionalness and the Spanish regional cuisine. Giving us examples of food from one region to another and how they compare.
Well, Spain is a small country. It's about the size of Texas. It's not very large, but it's incredibly geographically diverse and linguistically diverse. There are very different cultures within Spain. If you look at like Catalonia, which they speak their own language, Catalan, which is similar to Provençal French. The cuisine is very, very different, extremely different from Andalusia and southern Spain. Andalusia, you have a lot of fried food. They're masters of frying in olive oil. They do a lot of fried seafood, little teeny cuttlefish, or they'll do these little chanquetes, which are a teeny little white fish. And then obviously it's very hot in southern Spain. So in the summer, they have a lot of this where salmorejo and gazpacho comes from. They drink a lot of cold soups.
Yeah.
And then if you go up into the northern part of Catalonia and in the Pyrenees, it's a very alpine culture. The houses look almost like chalets. and the cuisine is much more hearty. A lot of stews and braises and game meat. They have a dish called trinchat, which is crushed potatoes with cabbage and fresh bacon, and it's sort of like Ooh. Colcannon, like yeah. something you would get in uh-huh. Ireland, or something you might get out of, you know, in Bavaria. So they're all over the region, depending upon what grows there, and the climate and the language and the culture. You find very, very different foods.
Is there any region in particular that, where did you spend the bulk of your time?
Well, I spent...
You've been there, you go...
Yeah, I lived there for five years yeah. on and off. But I spent the majority of my time between the Basque country in the north and Catalonia in Barcelona. But I've also spent some time in southern Spain as well. So I've seen quite a bit, you know, the diversity of the food in Spain. But there are areas that I love. I mean, I haven't been to Galicia since I was very young, but the food, the seafood from Galicia is incredible. I mean, it has these incredible octopus and turbo and
You have
scallops.
The lisp down very well.
I got that well. You know, you spend a lot of time there. You end up getting it. Yeah.
But so the seafood is...
Seafood's phenomenal. And seafood in general in Spain is really yeah. extraordinary.
Can you get the white bait here? I love the fried yeah. white bait. I love that. Can you? And do you serve that at Boca
We do. Yeah, we don't do it, all that often. It really depends. We get it fresh from Montauk. And when they catch it as a bycatch, we'll get our guys to bring it in for us. We can get it frozen as well, but it's not quite the same product.
Yeah,
it's really nice. They're just these gorgeous little guys, and we make a little batter for them and fry them in olive oil, and extraordinary.
And if anyone out there has not tasted a wonderful treat, you just pop yeah. them in your mouth a whole. Yeah. I mean, it's like anchovies, like bones yeah. and all. They're so little, you don't.
Yeah. yeah, they're like an inch and a half long. Mm. And they're teeny and delicious.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's beach. It reminds me of beach food.
Yeah.
Kind of,
it is beach food. It's very much southern Spain beach food. And the other great thing that I love about it, they're sustainable. I mean, they're very low on the food chain. They grow very quickly, and so it's not like you're taking a bluefin tuna, which takes years and years and years yeah. to mature. And you know, this is something that's it's sustainable, and it's a good way of eating seafood.
Well, it's like you say, it's a byproduct of the fisherman's catch. They just throw it out. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's wonderful. As far as the vegetables, anything different that you came across there that maybe is harder to find here, that you would like to use, or that you are going to grow yourself or have somebody grow
yeah,
for
well,
you?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things...
Or have someone grow for you.
Pimientos de Padrón are a great example of that. I mean, those are these wonderful peppers that, you know, for years you couldn't get in the U.S. And about... There was a couple of growers in California that were growing them, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. But now there's a handful of farmers in New Jersey that are growing them, and we get them in the summer, and... They're really, I mean, there's another pepper that we use, the shishito pepper, which yeah, is in the same yeah. family. It's a Japanese varietal, and that's something that's grown in large quantities in the U.S. So we use that as our pimientos de padrón during the winter, and then in the summer, once the real pimientos de padrón start coming around, that's what we switch to. And there's a farm that we work with in New Jersey that grows them for us, and they're just amazing, really incredible. But that was something that we didn't have, you know, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, that
yeah,
wasn't around.
Right. Well, even the shishito, I did not start my own plants from mm-hmm. seeds, and didn't have any seeds, didn't collect them. But every year I have a hard time finding the little, you know, plants.
Yeah.
I have one supplier, and I've got to go and get them early because they sell out
yeah.
right away.
Well, I can get them for you next year.
Good.
Yeah,
good. You know, I found another pepper. I think it's Mexican. I might not. I don't know if it's Spanish. It might be Mexican. Called suaro.
Suaro. That's not. That's probably Mexican.
Probably Mexican. And it looks and sounds. The characteristics of it. I put a couple in this season, and the characteristics of it sound like a larger shishito. And just to describe for our listeners, a shishito pepper is mild in flavor. It's not a hot pepper. And it, as you said, it's originally a Japanese variety, right?
Yeah.
And when it grows, it has this wrinkled-looking appearance. Of yeah. like, it looks like a little old man pepper.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like it grows up to maybe 2 inches long. It looks kind of, I don't know, almost like a date that's been kind of wrinkled up and extended. But they've got a very, very thin flesh and thin skin. So the typical preparation is just to fry them in olive oil and sprinkle them with really coarse sea salt, which is, of course, what we do. And it takes about 30 seconds in the olive oil. And
what a great,
you know,
appetizer.
It's
just
and they're
a
so
great
good.
Taste.
So
yeah.
good.
And when you pick them fresh off the bush, I mean, you could just pop them stem and all. In
oh,
your
yeah.
mouth. I mean,
yeah.
You could tell the ones that have been old and sitting for a while mm-hmm. and shipped out because, yeah. you know, the stems are really hard and dry.
But they really have a nice sort of fruity flavor. We get, It's funny that we were getting them for a while from a farm that was growing jalapenos right next to them. And there was some cross-pollination.
Yeah.
And we got these peppers that looked like shishito, but they were incredibly spicy.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. But they do also change depending upon the time of the season. They're spicier.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, and I learned from one of our guests, I've been trying to separate my
peppers.
Vegetables, yeah, my spicier peppers or the different types of tomatoes, so I don't get that. And we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, that's the exciting thing about gardening is you never know what's going to happen until it happens. And then you see, I mean, there's nothing more rewarding than seeing the flower and then the fruit and it grows until it's ready to pick it. It's really great.
Yeah. Well, it's just exciting that that so many restaurants in New York, not enough, mm-hmm. but I was talking with Amy Kotler mm-hmm. Last week about locavorism, mm-hmm. and having been a former chef, she said, unfortunately, not all chefs are cued into that, but
right.
I think more and more you find that chefs, I mean, I'm sure you would agree that chefs are really interested in the local foods and getting something obviously you always want the freshest ingredient you can get, right?
Yeah, and I think that more and more the guest is expecting it, and certainly my generation of cooks, we kind of grew up around that to a large degree. I mean, there's been a shift kind of from, I don't think it's sexy to get something FedExed from Japan, which was like the big thing.
It was a cool thing for a while, right?
Now I think it's sexy to get something. I mean, to me, it's sexy to get something from the Hudson Valley that just, you know, is in its prime. Yeah. Or to get, you know, something like bluefish, which is delicious, that we have in the water
right
here.
Right off the coast. Yeah,
yeah. Or the fluke, our local fluke, or the black bass we're getting right now. To me, I would much rather have black bass that's freshly caught locally and it's delicious and sweet than, you know, some other super soigné fish that's being flown in from God knows where.
That's right. And that is historically how people ate.
That's how people ate. There was no FedEx back in the 1880s.
Yeah. What has, talking about our heritage and our culture, not ours, but in the world, have you seen any major changes in the food, let's say, from when you were living in Spain, what was it? When did you first go there? Like,
well, the first time
I
was no more than that. It was almost 20 years ago, 1991.
And you just, you said you were just there last week. So have you, if there were to be a few major shifts that you've seen, anything in particular?
I think that there is a lot of the same trends that we see in the U.S. here. There was a rise in the late 90s, and well, there's the rise with sort of like with refined food and nouvelle cuisine in the early 80s, the late 70s, early 80s, and then Spain kind of went through a little bit of a gastronomic depression in the late 80s and the 90s. There was this kind of rise of refined, fancy fine dining that evolved into modern gastronomy in Spain, the what people erroneously call molecular gastronomy.
Yes.
And now there's been a bit of a...
Or biological, which
biological,
the organic.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Now there's been a bit of a sea change where there's a return to traditional roots and a re-examination of cuisine and saying, wait a second, this food came from someplace, let's get back to it. And that's something I think is really cool. I mean, getting back to what they call cocina de producto, which means basically product cooking. Means there's two trends in Spain. One is cocina de autor, which is autochthonous cooking, if you will. It's kind of like celebrating the chef as artist.
The chef artist, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the other is cocina de producto, where the real emphasis is on the product.
Let the ingredients speak.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's coming back coming into vogue, I should say. And I think one of the interesting things about it, one of the great things about, for lack of a better term, molecular gastronomy, is it has people have become incredible technicians as cooks. Mm. They've really kind of jumped into the science of cooking. You know, if you look at people like everything that Harold McGee has done to break down what actually happens to proteins and vegetables when we cook them, I think is extremely interesting and very valuable. And if you can take that and then apply it to more of what we call cocina de producto, this product-based cooking, you can really extract the maximum quality product from what you're working with. So, and that's something we try to do a lot in the restaurant, to handle things as little as is necessary to really bring out the best in the product. So to take a traditional style of cooking, but handle it with kind of a more educated hand. Mm-hmm. A little bit more of a deft hand. But still, you're getting just a piece of grilled squid with a beautiful olive oil vinaigrette.
Yeah, you know. But you know, it's just, as you said, it's all in the way it's handled.
It's the way it's done, exactly.
Lack of handling, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's great. Well, the dishes at Boca Rio certainly speak of to this. And it's so nice that you're, you know, bringing this tradition to New Yorkers. And I would encourage anyone visiting New York or living here who are listening that there are two opportunities to visit Boca Rio.
If one's packed, you can go to the other.
Good luck. No, you can always stand up and at the bar and get a drink.
Right? Absolutely. Get some snacks while you're waiting for a table.
Yeah, well, that's great. And I was also very pleased as I walked by the other day to see that you are also bringing the other tradition, the Spanish tradition, that's the World Cup.
The World Cup.
You've got the World Cup playing.
And football, we start tomorrow, and we're doing, unfortunately, the schedule is such that it's kind of an early time to drink sangria and have patatas bravas.
Yeah, they're playing ball when we're having
exactly.
breakfast.
Exactly, right? But we're doing a special menu in the morning, so we'll be open for breakfast at 9:30 at both locations, and we're going to be showing all of the games. At 9:30 and at 12:30, we're going to redo. And at 2:30, we're going to do the 7:30 a.m. game. So we'll show all the games throughout the day, and we have food starting at 9:30 in the morning.
Oh, terrific! And we can, you know, jump up and do some Spanish cheers.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's really
thank
been
you.
Interesting, and I really I really appreciate the fact that there are some real authentic traditions that you are carrying on.
Thank you very much.
And hopefully we'll talk again.
Great. Thanks, Linda. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening. I would like to thank Hearst Ranch for being our sponsor today. And, of course, our producer, Jack Inslee, and engineer, Nat Wiener. I'm Linda Palaccio, and this has been A Taste of the Past.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.